Great. So I'm Rick Hansen. It's the 6th of January, right? 2016. And, you know, mindfulness is all the rage, right? When you've made it on the cover of Time magazine, you know that your star is rising or about to fall, right? And so you've seen pictures of people on Time magazine looking all coiffed and, you know, wonderful, meditating mindfully. There's a magazine called Mindful. There are all kinds of applications of it. When you see pictures of young Marines in boot camp meditating to prepare themselves for the stresses of warfare, you figure that mindfulness has kind of gotten pretty mainstream. And in response to some of that proliferation of mindfulness, there's a kind of pushback around, well, what is mindfulness? And is it just being used to prepare people for warfare of various kinds, you know, including corporate warfare? Or is it continuing to be used in some wholesome way? So this year I'd like to explore mindfulness in general and mindfulness as applied to a number of topics, including bringing in my own background as a clinical psychologist, exploring some of the ways in which greater mindfulness for the layers of our own psyche, informed by 100 years at least of research and clinical practice in Western psychology, as well as informed by some deeper and deeper knowledge about the evolution of our own brain that we inhabit and which in some sense inhabits us. That's what I hope to cover with you this year. So as part of my generosity for you, I would like to pass out the core teachings of the Buddha about mindfulness, the Satipatthana Sutta. And we will have these available here routinely. Feel free to take them home with you. If you lose your copy, feel free to grab more. If you forget your copy and you don't bring it, you know, feel free to just come here and use some. And so this is the Buddha's gift to you, right, through me and FedEx Kinko's, hopefully with partially recycled paper, at least. So grab a copy, pass it along. And you don't need to read it right now in this moment, and there will be no tests. Well, there will be a test, but it won't be a graded test. Be a karmic test. Yeah, coming back there, plenty of them. There are tons extra. If they're in the loose copies, just, you know, leave them on the floor, or pass them on. More here? Great. This is so much fun passing these out. Thank you. And if you don't receive my generosity, I can't give it. See? What a good teaching. Yeah? Questions. So you have a question about the logistics of what we're just handing out here?
Are there any more?
Oh, there are tons more. There's a big pile over there. I have more. I feel like Johnny Appleseed, Johnny Mindfulness Seed, right? That's kind of fun. Okay? So, the handout, I'll wait till everybody has it, and then we'll keep going. Everybody have the handout? Want some more? There are a bunch piled on the table as well. Okay? And you don't have to take it if you don't want to take it. It's great. Okay. So, let me see if I can set this up properly. Everybody have kind of a handout? So, that particular handout is a translation of this fundamental practice instruction from the Buddha. And like everything he said, and everything I say, and everything I try to pass on that he said, see for yourself. Always see for yourself. And as he emphasized again and again, what's true is important, but what's useful is even more important. So at the end of the day, you know, as I've said before, in the great Dharma question of Dr. Phil, so, how's that working for you? In other words, is it helpful or harmful? Does it create suffering or joy in oneself and in other people? So this particular translation is taken from Anaglio's book, the monk Anaglio, who's actually German-born and has extraordinary command of English. This is a wonderful book that really applies and deepens these core teachings in the Satipatthana Sutta. Sati means mindfulness, and I'll be getting into that. And patthana simply means establishment or foundation, or where is mindfulness to be practiced? What are we mindful of? Okay, so if you want to check out this book, it's really a great resource. And as context here, tonight I'd like to talk about, in my view, the foundation of the four foundations of mindfulness. Like, what's all this about? What's the point? Why should we care? And certainly have some discussion about this. Okay? So as context, I want to read a different teaching that it is said the Buddha said. And this is from the Dhammapada. He says here, through countless births in the cycle of existence, I have run, not finding, although seeking, the builder of this house. And again, I faced the suffering of new birth. O house builder, now you are seen. You shall not build a house again for me. All your beams are broken. The ridge pole is shattered. The mind has become freed from conditioning. The end of craving has been reached. Okay. And the point of that passage, you don't have to buy the underlying cosmology of reincarnation, cycles of birth and death and rebirth. You could take it as metaphor. In some sense, in this life, in any single biological life, we have many, many cycles of birth, death, and rebirth. In effect, every night we go to sleep and we have a little death of sorts and we wake up again the next day. Or you can take it in terms of the cosmology that the Buddha lived in as context and he taught himself with this larger backdrop of countless lives. But either way, he's speaking to this fundamental process of the construction, the building of the ordinary house of consciousness, the ordinary conventional life. And you can feel in there his view that that ordinary house is full of termites, you know, it's full of trouble, it's full of suffering, and yet it's relentlessly built and rebuilt, life after life, moment after moment. And also you can hear in here there's a possibility of complete freedom from that conventional, saturated with suffering architecture. Like that's radical, like a joyfulness. And you can hear his own joy that in his own case, he found that freedom. Very radically. The technical term that I've learned is soteriological. It has to, in other words, Buddhism at root is about salvation. It's not salvation in the Judeo-Christian, Abrahamic religion sense, including Islam. It's more of a psychological kind of, psychologically defined salvation. But it's really about a full, radical, irrevocable transformation of mind and heart. Okay, that's the fundamental aim. My own personal metaphor as a longtime wilderness, mountaineer, rock climbing kind of guy, is if full awakening is like Mount Olympus, there may be slightly smaller mountains in the Himalayas and then other smaller mountains in the Alps or the Sierra Nevada, and then we have the local hills, and then we have the dusty plains. And it helps to have a view of the fullness of Mount Everest and some confidence in a path that leads at least in that direction. And then the fundamental question is, what's my next step? Step after step. After step. So it's in that context, really, of a radical critique of the ordinary construction of our psychology, our moment-to-moment experience of living, the ordinary construction of our relationship to living, and a view of the possibility of irrevocable, fundamental, transformative freedom from that process and the wonderfulness of that. So it's in that context, then, that he talks about mindfulness as the direct one-way path to that fundamental liberation, that fundamental unshakable freedom of mind and heart. Okay. So in that context then, to quote a little bit of the passages in your handout that you've got, I want to just emphasize and repeat again what I said at the beginning and also at 7 o'clock of the meditation practice, and then talk a bit about, in my view, what is the foundation of the four foundations of mindfulness, especially in the 21st century? Okay? Good. And I will slow down for questions and comments from time to time. So he says, as I said before, people, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of dukkha, translated typically as suffering or stress, and discontent, the disappearance of discontent, for acquiring the true method for the realization of nibbana, nirvana, full awakening, namely the four satipatthanas, the four establishings or foundations of mindfulness. Okay, so he's setting it up. He's saying, I've named the problem, the ordinary conventional psychology. I've said it's possible to solve that problem, and it's wonderful. And now you probably want to know how to do it. Here's how to do it. That's essentially what he's setting up here, in really ordinary terms. And he's not saying how to do it is to be saved outside yourself by some supernatural or transcendental force. He's saying how to do it is you got to do it. But if you do it, it will bear fruit for you. Okay? I'm hearing the guy, Men's Warehouse, in the back of my mind. I guarantee it, the Buddha says. Okay? So what are we doing? What is this fundamental practice? And there's a lot of detail in the Satipatthana, and there are good footnotes in the book itself that clarify some of it in modern terms. But the essence of the practice is really given in this recurring refrain. In other words, in regard to something, there are four major somethings that he names, and I think it's really okay to add a few more as the year goes on, informed by 2,500 more years of knowledge about the human mind and brain. But he names basically four. In regard to the body, okay? Second, in regard to what psychologists today call the hedonic tone of experience, he called it the feeling tone. The feeling tone doesn't mean emotion per se. It means the sense of experience as pleasant, you know, tastes good. Or the sense of experience is unpleasant, ick, tastes bad. Or the sense of experience is neutral. As if you've hung out with me a little bit, you know, I think a fourth hedonic tone is actually starting to emerge and is meaningful to call out. The sense of things is heartfelt, which has to do in part with our deeply social nature. As the most social mammal, primate, the most social species on the planet. But I'll just stay with the Buddhist structure here, which is also a very common one found in Western psychology, you know, approaching the pleasant, avoiding the unpleasant, and wishing the neutral would hurry up and get pleasant. Right? Okay? Approach, avoid. Okay? All right. Okay. So he basically says that's the second thing we are to be mindful of. Okay? The third is really the overall quality of the mind. We'll get into some of the detail of that, but it basically boils down to in your mind, are you craving or not? And also in the mind, is there a sense of disturbance and distractedness or a sense of concentration and centeredness? That's essentially the third place we locate, mindfulness. And then in the fourth, it's kind of a catch-all category, the so-called dhammas or dharmas. In other words, a variety of themes, like the six aspects of our senses, hearing, seeing, tasting, touching, smelling, and thought altogether. Is mindfulness located there? In the fourth catch-all category are things like the seven factors of awakening. Are we mindful of whether we're mindful? Whether we're investigating, whether there's energy, whether there's joy, whether there's tranquility or concentration or equanimity. Or also in that fourth catch-all category, we have the Four Noble Truths. The noble truth or the ennobling truth, as it's sometimes translated, of suffering, of craving, of freedom from craving, and the path that embodies and leads increasingly to that freedom from craving. Okay, so it's a lot of material. But the essence of it is, in regard to that which we are mindful of, we are diligent. Coach Buddha wants us to keep at it, right? It's diligent. Are we diligent? Or are we living in the world of kind of like the one-minute meditator, you know, where we just fast food, fast awakening, you know, just like that? Are we diligent? Do we do our own work? Also, are we clearly knowing? There's a quality of clarity of mind rather than being foggy, distracted. Are we free from desires and discontent? in particular, in regard to the world. In other words, when we are being mindful to some extent, we use this word frequently, seclude ourselves. We may be fully engaged, driving in traffic, dealing with our kids, preparing a dinner, dealing with something at work. But in some fundamental sense, in our innermost being, in our core, we are secluded from all that and free in our relationship to it, and free from desire or discontent, desire for the pleasant, discontent about the unpleasant in regard to the world. And we're going to be exploring a lot of this. We have a year to do this, okay? Also, he says, and that's actually, that's it. So we have diligence, clarity, clearly knowing, and free in some way from being yanked to and fro, moment after moment, toward the pleasant or away from or against the unpleasant. Okay? Or wanting the neutral to hurry up and get pleasurable. All right. So that's the essence of it all. In terms of my own view about all this, there's a fair amount of controversy about what is it to be mindful in the first place. And I'll, in here, tend to come back to again and again my understanding of the fundamental root meaning of the word for mindfulness in the early teachings of the Buddha, which is essentially sustained present moment awareness. We could be aware of these four major locations or places to establish mindfulness or aware of other things, but it's sustained presence, sustained present moment awareness. The root of the word for mindfulness in the language of early Buddhism, the word being sati, is recollectedness or memory. We're recollected. We're not forgetful. Okay. In the recollectedness, there are these two fundamental aspects of mindfulness. One, a kind of metacognitive awareness of awareness. There's a kind of attention to attention from time to time. We keep paying attention a little bit to how well we're paying attention. In deep states of absorption, that mindfulness becomes completely, it doesn't need to be deliberate any longer. It's completely sustained and automatic. It's just unstoppable. But short of that, the mind wanders, right? Even practice meditators, well-intended practice meditators, the mind wanders. We bring it back. It's that metacognitive awareness of awareness, you know, gentle returning that's recollected, right? So that's an essential aspect of mindfulness in its core. And the other is the knowing. There's a knowing. There's an awareness of what we are mindful of. Sometimes it's described as clear comprehension. We comprehend. There's a knowing of what we're mindful of. The Buddha was once asked, you know, or he used the metaphor of a little baby. You know, he basically said, a little baby, at least in the ways he was describing it, is not enlightened. You know, yes, the baby's awake, but the baby lacks that quality of comprehension and recollected, sustained awareness that's really involved, in the Buddha's view at least, a full awakening. Okay, so the way I'm going to use mindfulness here is in a fairly narrow sense, sustained present moment awareness. That sustained present moment awareness is assisted by a variety of other mental factors, but is not those other factors. There's been a huge blurring of the meaning of mindfulness these days in the popular culture, in my view and the view of many others, or you could say a stretching of the meaning of the term so that it encompasses all sorts of stuff. So for example, mindfulness itself is not acceptance. Acceptance assists and supports sustained present moment awareness. Mindfulness is not self-compassion. They're distinct. By being clear that they're distinct, we can appreciate the value of each. And of course, having compassion for oneself facilitates ongoing mindfulness. Mindfulness itself is not tranquility. And yet tranquility supports ongoing mindfulness. Mindfulness itself is not intention. And yet the intention to be mindful supports ongoing mindfulness. Okay? Flip the other way, what are the fruits of mindfulness? You know, a major model in mindfulness research is that mindfulness, the benefits of mindfulness are achieved basically through four pathways that intertwine synergistically and support each other. For one, through practicing mindfulness, we train attention. That's really useful. In terms of the brain and experience-dependent neuroplasticity, what we pay attention to gets converted to neural structure, especially if it's negative. So getting control over that vacuum cleaner of attention that's sucking its contents into our brain, particularly if it's negative material because of the brain's negativity bias, is really useful. Being able to sustain attention in class when it's not that interesting. Nobody has ADD in a video or playing video games, right? Because they're so stimulating, okay? But to be able to sustain attention when it's not that stimulating, to be able to pull attention away from what's not useful and keep it where it is useful, that's incredibly powerful, and in my own view, that's fundamental to self-reliance and autonomy. And we live in a culture in which people are ever more clever at seducing, hijacking, compelling, and capturing attention. You know, you go on a website, you know, just for a silly, trivial example, you want to read some column on the New York Times. You're looking at it on your screen, and there's this little movie running right next to it, or this flashing light right next to it. I just want to read the text. Why'd you put the text there if you didn't want me to read it? Ring, ring, ring. You know, it's hard, like, for example, my dad, when he was alive, he had a hard time watching modern movies because there are cuts every few seconds to recapture attention. Whereas our kids, for them to watch a movie made in the 80s by somebody like Sam Peckinpah, Straw Dogs, a lot of sex and violence in that movie, it's boring because there's not stimulating enough. Peckinpah is not stimulating enough? Okay, see what I'm saying? So in our time, it's especially important to have attention training. Okay. Second major pathway for the benefits of mindfulness is self-awareness. You'll learn a lot about yourself when you slow it down to track what's really going on inside. You know, mindfulness is experiential. It's embodied. It's intimate. It's a deepening intimacy with ourselves. So one of the things that supports sustained mindfulness, especially mindfulness of our innards, is distress tolerance, is technical term, is being able to tolerate our sadness, our anxiety, the little creepy crawlers that emerge as we start turning over rocks, you know, our old pain, our unresolved feelings, our longings that hurt to become aware of, our unfulfilled longings. You know, we need to be able to tolerate those to expand in our self-awareness. So that's an example of factors that support mindfulness. But certainly through self-knowledge, you know thyself, right? We get a lot of value from our practices of mindfulness, not just during meditation, but especially in everyday life. Okay. Third major pathway to the fruits of mindfulness is considered to be through self-regulation. We become more able to regulate, to control, to direct our feelings. We become more able to manage our desires, our impulses. We become more able to manage our habits, our tendencies. You know, the expression of what we learned in childhood, let's say, that made tons of sense when we were 3 or 13, but today it's like walking around in a suit of armor 10 sizes too small, right? Or gets us in trouble when strategies or methods that worked, you know, back in the day, back in the hood, but today are problematic in a business setting or in a long-term relationship or raising children, let's say. Self-regulation. And then the fourth pathway, as it were, is considered to be a changing relationship or sense of self. Here you start finding more of the insight, vipassana, so-called, the insight aspects, where we start recognizing that self is fluid and changing and dynamic rather than fixed and brick-like. It's made up of many parts. And we start getting more and more of a sense that there really is no auteur. There's no great screenwriter or director or conductor, you know, managing the whole process. That very much the apparent I is not in the front of the train, you know, as the engineer, but back in the caboose, kind of manage the bumpy ride. Okay? Changing sense of self, loosening up, taking life less and less personally, feeling more at one with things, feeling more at ease, feeling less positional, less attached, less identified, less possessive, less caught up in my precious and all the rest of that. Okay? So those are sort of the, so far, kind of laying it out. Good. Okay? So then to bring it down to kind of practicalities, what are we doing to gain the benefits of mindfulness and to, as the Buddha talks about, engage this one-way path? Right? And here I think of three fundamental sort of aims or values, let's say, and places to look for yourself. First of all, we gradually expand the breadth of our mindfulness, of our awareness. Internally, we become more and more aware of our own body. I don't know about you, but I landed in adulthood numb from the neck down. You know, a lot for me, life, as Samuel Bonder puts it, has been a process of waking down, not so much waking up. So we expand to include the body. We expand to include our emotions, right, internally. We expand to include all those little intentions, all those little voices, all those little agendas running in our mind, right? We expand. We expand to include the various establishings of mindfulness, like tracking the hedonic tone, the feeling tone of experience, which follows after a stimulus, right? Something happens. It's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And then we tend to, you know, grasp after the pleasant and push away the unpleasant. Right? We become more aware of that. Okay, so we expand the breadth internally and we expand it externally. Empathy is interpersonal mindfulness. Deepening our insight into others is an extension of mindfulness. We expand our sense of the causes of happiness or suffering, including outside ourselves. Like, oh, you know, I long for love, but I'm not doing anything about that. Oh, I'm unhappy in my work, I think I've hit a ceiling, but I'm not doing anything about that. Or, oh, when I act this way in my relationships, or act this way with my own body, in terms of exercise or intoxicants or sleep, things go better. When I act that way, things go worse. We're expanding our breadth of what we're mindful of. Right? So you might ask yourself, you know, what's the next f-stop? In a sense, what's the next expansion of the aperture, the breadth of your internally applied or externally applied mindfulness? Right? For me, for example, it's been a very useful practice to track, to expand the breadth of my tracking of fear, because fear is such a primal emotion in all its subtleties, and also track externally other people feeling threatened or alarmed by me, or invaded or pushed or uncomfortable or something, you know, or in some ways threatened. Like, that's been a very useful thing internally and externally for me to become more and more mindful of, more and more broadly aware. Okay? So we have breadth. We also have depth. In other words, in our own psychology, can we become increasingly mindful of the lower, deeper, more vulnerable, more fundamental layers in our own psyche? Can we track the hurt under anger? Can we track the fear of abandonment and loss that's associated with the longing for closeness that then drives a distancing of other people, even though we'd really like more intimacy in our relationships, Can we track that? Can we track the subtle auto cravings for sweets or intoxicants or for things from other people that just want them and then make up reasons why they're important? Can we track that deep down in ourselves, right? And as the Buddha taught a lot, can we become more and more concentrated in our mindfulness so we can have an increasing depth of granularity of our own experience? So we're really tracking the arising and passing away of little half-second units of experience. You know, can we track, you know, the cascade that follows from something being pleasant within a second or two, us really wanting it? Can we follow that out? Can we deepen the granularity of our awareness and even insight into our own experience as well as other people? Can we track micro expressions going across people's faces when we're interacting with them? You know, I remember this look our daughter had when she was about three. Laurel's very, very determined. And she had taken a position about, I forget, some article of clothing, like she was going to wear the green sweatshirt, even though it's filthy. And she was going to wear that sweatshirt. And she was prepared to go to war as a three-year-old for that sweatshirt. And I watched her. Her outer expression was angry and intense and, you know, going to war. And there was this little place in her, I could see it, that was horrified by what she was doing. Like the rider of a horse, you know, this is freaking out that it's running away, right? But the bulk of her was the horse that was really attached to that green sweatshirt. So the point is, can we see that kind of thing in other people in terms of depth of mindfulness? Okay, and there are other examples of that. And the
Did
third,
she wear the sweatshirt?
Yeah, she ended up with the sweatshirt. Because I could see that he was not going to go anywhere. Good. Okay, irresistible force alert. You know, while being prepared definitely to exercise parental authority, probably more than she wished for as a kid. So the last is, how sustained is your mindfulness? So we have breadth, depth, and sustain. Just about anybody can be mindful for half a breath, right? Can we sustain that present moment awareness through an entire single breath cycle, and then 10 breaths in a row, and then the breaths continuously for 45 minutes of the meditation, for example? Or even literally, can we sustain at least some genuine background awareness of the breath throughout an entire day? Which is obviously, these are challenging aspirations. What's the continuity, right? So that's in sum, and then I want to create some time for comments and so forth. That's in sum what I hope to explore with you, especially this year. How do we expand the breadth of our mindfulness? How to expand the depth of it? And how do we establish more and more continuity of it? And all of that can sound, you know, kind of complicated. And what I would really boil it down to, of course, is Ram Dass's great three words, right? Be here now. Okay. Questions or comments so far? And then I'll try to wrap on time at 8:30. Great, sure.
I struggle. It's almost like she wants here, it makes sense. You're back home, like at work, it doesn't make sense. How not to be content with what's happening in the world, with
right.
What's happening in my job, or what's a nurse, or
whatever. Right. Yeah.
Very concerning, and I struggle.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Because of Ramdan onto them.
Yeah.
And I can get being aware.
Yeah.
Yet not feeling it with them.
Yeah.
Or sense with them. So I know that's extreme, but to me there's that those stepping stones are
yeah.
all throughout the day.
Yeah.
And
sure.
Like,
It's a huge central question, and it's often one of the critiques. It becomes a critique mounted against spiritual practice in general, you know, that it's not engaged enough with social justice, helping the world be a better place, including very, very locally, you know, the person who's in your face right now. And it's huge, it's really important. So a couple of things about it. One of the major factors of mindfulness is ethics. Because if we are harming ourselves, that's a failure of ethics. Or if we're harming other people, that tends to be disturbing. That stirs up a lot of stuff. So even though a sniper, a burglar, a bandit could be very, very mindful, it's also true that ethics serves mindfulness. And in our larger frame here, we are using mindfulness in the service of something that I at least, and I think you as well, would consider to be valuable and ethical and wholesome and worth doing, which is to say, to gradually, disengage from those things that create suffering and harm for ourselves and other people. So key, really, really important point, ethics and mindfulness go together. Fundamentally. Second point is that alongside that mindfulness can be wise effort, should be wise effort, where we speak truth to power or we confront abuse, let's say, or we have anger or fieriness or fierceness arise about something, or we have sorrow for what's happening to other people. Our heart is really, really moved alongside our mindfulness. You know, again, in the modern understanding often of mindfulness, it's taken to mean a kind of radical passivity, a choiceless awareness, a bare witnessing, and only that in relation to experience. And yet, as the Buddha taught and other teachers as well, there must also be wise effort. We must also try to reduce and release what's quote-unquote negative, what's harmful, what causes suffering, and also grow what's quote-unquote positive, what's beneficial, what leads to happiness and benefit for ourselves and other people. So wise effort is perfectly all right alongside our mindfulness. They're not contradictory, as it's often represented. Very important point. Right? And then to your point about discontent and freed from desire and discontent, right, in regard to the world. And I, like a lot of people, have really grappled with that. How do you find what's described as the balance of compassion and equanimity? How do you have both? You know, I think of this Christian prayer often these days, as I understand it, dear Lord, teach me to care and not to care. And you can feel the truth, the power of that. Teach me to care and not to care, in a sense. And the artist did not go too far in either direction, right? We can go too far with equanimity, and we start saying stuff like, it's all for the good, man, whatever, you know, best of all possible worlds. It's all, you know, I don't think Hitler was doing the best he could, right? You can go to extremes of compassion where you're so flooded by an open heart and being moved by caring for other people that you can't sustain effort to help the world be a better place. You have compassion fatigue, caregiver burnout, and so forth. So really the art is to find a place where you can both have your heart wide open to the world and still walk evenly over uneven ground. So the way I myself hold it is that desire and discontent still arises, okay? And there's a difference for me between discontent, where I feel hijacked, I'm stressed, I'm upset, and, you know, compassion or fieriness or really caring about something. My dad was, as you probably know, he went through about 3.5 months of a lot of health drama and then eventually died. During that health drama phase, I was very, very engaged with his care. And in different ways, my wife and my son both said to me, hey, what are you doing? And I said, look, if your kid was in a burning building, you'd be driven too, you know. I was calm inside, but I was driven. And I remember going to Haiti the very first time. I still don't have much experience with genuinely quote-unquote third-world countries. And the state I was in on my first visit, I best describe later, I was just there for about 2 days, really, almost 48 hours beginning to end. I was in a cold rage. I was calm. I was clear. I was tracking threat around me. I was solving problems. I was in a cold rage. I could not believe how these people were living. You know, it's one thing to know it abstractly or see it on the evening news or have someone tell you. It's another thing to just see it, you know. But I don't think I was discontented in the way the Buddha means it. I wasn't disturbed in my core. And to finish my thread on this point, I think about his key teaching is in his own launch, his kind of final runway to awakening, as he was describing what it was like to be Siddhartha. He said, you know, basically during that final run-up, things arose in me, right? Discontent and desire, to paraphrase, arose in me, including extremely intense, right? Blissful, pleasant experiences for which he had desire, and he did a lot of austerities, a lot of ascetic practices, racking pains that were very, very unpleasant, okay? Desire and discontent, as it were, arose in my mind, but they did not invade my mind and remain. They did not invade to the core, right? They glided through, they passed through his mind. So I think that's it. We may be there as we are the container, we are the space. And that's what mindfulness gives us so much, a kind of maha shock absorber, right? In which we're present and in our mind may well be desire and discontent. We're so pissed off about such and such, or we really want that cigarette, right? Or we really want to say that thing to them. Or we really want that one last opportunity to ask that person to forgive us and they're no longer alive, right? We want it. And yet it's contained in a larger space that's untroubled. And the repeated practice of mindfulness, breath, depth, and continuity gives us that. How about we sit for a minute and... Oh, I should tell you, I will be gone for 3 weeks. And Tarne will be carrying this forward as our guest teacher about mindfulness and bringing a lot to it, I'm sure. And then I'll be back here the first week of February. Okay? So bottom line takeaway, be here now. Thank you for your practice. Thank you, and stay mindful.